Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is J.W. Peters Incorporated versus Bridge Structural and Reinforcing Iron Workers Local Union 1 et al. Mr. Gore?
May it please the court. The facts in this case are not complex, nor are the issues presented to the court. The threshold issue concerns the jurisdiction of the federal court to entertain this matter. While the district court initially ruled that J.W. Peters had a pre-hire agreement with Iron Workers Local 1, he later ruled there was no case or controversy and dismissed the matter. It is this ruling that the judge's initial ruling that J.W. Peters could not repudiate its agreement, which are at issue. First, there's no dispute between the parties on the issue of jurisdiction. Both Local 1 and J.W. Peters agree that the court had jurisdiction to decide the matter. Both agree that the underlying dispute in this case concerns the validity of the collective bargaining agreement and the breach of that entire agreement by J.W. Peters. As the Supreme Court stated in Textron, if a breach of the contract is alleged, the courts have the right to determine the contract issue, contract coverage issue. This court has also ruled in numerous cases prior to the Supreme Court's ruling in Textron, including IBEW versus Sinecraft, Operating Engineers Local 150 versus Rabin, that the court has jurisdiction to decide contract coverage issues, the very issue presented in the instant case. In the instant case, the question presented must necessarily deal with a breach of contract, as it is the repudiation or the continued validity of the entire agreement which are at issue here. Moreover, as this court stated in Teamsters National Auto Transporters versus Trohaw, Section 301 authorizes suits for violations of contracts. The court stated that when the purpose of the lawsuit effectuates the goals of Section 301, then it is appropriate for the federal court to embrace such suits. Accordingly, the federal court has jurisdiction to hear this matter, as the issue concerning the breach of the entire contract is the issue presented by both parties. Once the court has passed the jurisdictional issue, the issue becomes whether or not J.W. Peters had the right to repudiate its agreement with Local 1 and what such a repudiation means in terms of any contractual obligations to the union under Section 301. McNeff is instructive in this regard. In McNeff, the Supreme Court stated that the union may bring suit to collect monetary damages until such time that the contract is repudiated. The court left open the issue as to when a contract may be repudiated. However, time and time again, the NLRB has stated that when an employer employs one or no employees on a stable basis, an employer may lawfully repudiate a collective bargaining agreement. Both before and after DECWLA, there has always been a recognized rule of law that if an employer employs fewer than two, one or no, bargaining unit employees on a permanent basis, it may unilaterally withdraw recognition and repudiate the union contract before its termination date. In the context of an 8F pre-hire agreement, Stack Electric controls. In Stack Electric, the NLRB stated it's well settled that if an employer employs one or fewer employees on a permanent basis, the employer may withdraw recognition and repudiate its contract or unilaterally change employees' terms and conditions of employment without affording the union the opportunity to bargain. Similarly, in Haas Garage Door, the NLRB reiterated its concept that an employer may repudiate a pre-hire 8F contract when it has no more than a single permanent employee. In Haas, the employer repudiated its 8F contract, and the administrative law judge initially ruled the employer could not repudiate the 8F agreement because of the holding in DECWLA. The full board reversed and held that despite DECWLA, the employer was not bound to the pre-hire agreement as it had no employees doing bargaining unit work. Based upon the NLRB's rulings in such issues, under this court's holdings in BUFCO, in which the court noted that the court should give deference to the NLRB in issues such as this, J.W. Peters respectfully requests that this court adopt the board's rulings concerning the company's right to repudiate an agreement when it has fewer than two employees.
So far, only the Ninth Circuit has recognized that exception.
That's correct. Under the holding of McNeff, once the contract has been repudiated, the union has no enforcement right under Section 301. While it appears that this court has not directly faced this issue, other circuits have. In Laborers' Health and Welfare Trust Fund for Northern California, a Ninth Circuit case in which the facts were similar to the underlying case, the court found that the employer had never employed more than one individual performing laborers' work and had no plans to hire employees in the future. The trust fund argues, as the union argues in the instant case, that the employer could not repudiate an 8F contract midterm. However, the Ninth Circuit rejected the benefit trust fund's contention and stated that post-equitable decisions by the board speak not only in terms of the standard application of the one-employee unit rule, where there is no statutory obligation to bargain, but also in terms of lawful unilateral repudiation of a Section 8F agreement where there is a single or no employee unit. The court went on to adopt the NLRB's reasoning in such cases. More importantly, the court also found that the one-man unit rule rendered an agreement void and not merely voidable, since the bargaining unit was dissolved when the company repudiated the agreement. Therefore, J.W. Peters respectfully requests that this court find that it has jurisdiction to decide the issue presented, and also that it find that J.W. Peters had the right to repudiate its agreement with Local 1, and in fact, it repudiated its agreement. We respectfully urge the court to find that J.W. Peters' repudiation of the agreement was lawful, or in the alternative, to remand this case back to the district court to issue a ruling consistent with the NLRB's holdings in such matters.
Mr. Gore, you're familiar with the Martin versus Garmin construction case?
Yes, certainly.
You want to tell us how we, if we were to follow the reasoning of the Ninth Circuit, how we might address any tension between that case and the Westlake case?
Martin presents a different set of facts in that the lower court found on a collateral estoppel basis that the NLRB had ruled there was a contract. The NLRB in the Martin versus Garmin in the underlying case addressed only an issue of the violation of the NLRA, and it found that because the company had only employed one or no employees, that there was no violation of the act. However, there is a statement by the NLRB in that case that there was a valid agreement. In this case, there's been no holding by the NLRB that there is a valid agreement.
Thank you. You want to reserve the rest of your time?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Gore. Mr. Deedy.
Good morning, Your Honor. For the record, Patrick D. on behalf of Ironworkers Local 1. I'm also here to represent the co-defendant in this case, the Associated Steel Workers of Chicago. As Your Honor has noted, with respect to this case, we believe and we indicate in our briefs that this court's prior decisions, both in Martin versus Gorman, Baylor Heating, and also Seinkraft, all would suggest that those cases should be extended to include the specific facts involved here with respect to the second issue in the case. But let me first address the jurisdictional question, because I think that although it is true that both parties agree that the court had jurisdiction on April 29th when Judge Shader originally ruled, I think it's important to recognize that at that particular time, Judge Shader was looking at the threshold issue with respect to whether or not to require these parties to submit the dispute, which both parties agree was in existence, to the Joint Arbitration Board under the Collective Bargaining Agreement. And it is our position with respect to this matter that on that threshold issue, I think clearly Judge Shader had jurisdiction. In fact, he would have the ultimate jurisdiction to decide whether or not there was a valid contract in place at that time and whether or not, in this case, J.W. Peters would be required to actually participate in that process. As Mr. Gore has indicated, there was clearly a dispute between J.W. Peters and the ironworkers with respect to whether or not it could lawfully terminate the contract. The contract specifically provided for only written termination at the end of the contract period. This was an attempt in April of 2004 to terminate a contract at that particular time immediately, which would not have been allowed to be terminated under its terms until May 31st, 2006. It is the union's claim that the April 2nd letter by J.W. Peters attempting to repudiate was, in fact, a violation of the contract, those specific terms, and that was the dispute they were seeking to resolve at the Joint Arbitration Board, which was a mandatory arbitration provision under the Collective Bargaining Agreement. J.W. Peters, at that hearing on April 29th, argued to the court that because of this one-man unit rule, it should be allowed to abrogate the contract immediately and not be required to submit the matter to arbitration. We believe that on the basis of the cases, both Textron and Signcraft and Raven and this court, that for all those reasons, we believe that the district court had jurisdiction to decide the case in April, and it properly denied the motion to stay and dismiss the complaint. With respect to the second issue in this case, the one-man unit rule, it is the contention of Ironworkers Local 1 and the Associated Steel Erectors that the one-man unit rule should not be applied to Section 301 actions for breach of contract for several reasons.
But why shouldn't we follow the reasoning of the NLRB? There have been many decisions, and also the rationale of the Ninth Circuit, which I think makes sense when you look at it in the context of this rule. You know, give me your best argument as to why we shouldn't adopt that reasoning.
First of all, I think that the court in McNeff versus Todd recognized that there's a critical distinction between the statutory duty to bargain under the NLRA and the contractual obligations under 301. And that was clearly set forth in both the Baylor Heating case by this court, in the Martin versus Gorman case, in this court. And those distinctions are important with respect to, in this context, a pre-hire agreement, which at any point in time during the life of that contract may not actually have any employees in the unit. Here, in this instance, as indicated in both Garmin and Haas and Stack, all those cases, the NLRB went to great lengths to determine first whether or not there was a valid contract. In each of those cases, the NLRB did not, as Mr. Gore would suggest to you, find the particular contract void. What it said was it had a valid contract with respect to each of those particular collective bargaining agreements. Each of those unions had a contract right. The limited holding in each of those cases on the affirmative defense or the one-man unit rule was strictly limited to the statutory obligation to bargain. And the NLRB's determination with respect to that is within the exclusive jurisdiction of the NLRB. In this particular case, in other cases like this, in Martin versus Gorman, for instance, this court held contrary to the Ninth Circuit's rulings both in the Westlake development and the earlier decision, which was a pre-Declan case, relied on that, the Beck Engineering case, that in fact that here there are other contractual obligations that may arise. In this particular case, there was no harm to J.W. Peters to require it to maintain this particular contract through its term. The mere fact that there's no employees in the unit at that particular time isn't the only issue with respect to the relationship between J.W. Peters and the Ironworkers Local 1. With respect to other issues in the case and other potential contract violations, they're not dependent on whether or not there's any particular employees in the unit at the time that the violation occurred. A good example of that would be a situation where the contractor has subcontracted bargaining unit work to another contractor, and this particular agreement has a specific provision requiring the subcontracting of such work to other ironworker signatory contractors. The mere fact that J.W. Peters may not for a year or 2 years have any particular employees in the unit, that is, that employed itself, doesn't mean that it didn't employ through subcontracting of that particular work to other union contractors, other bargaining unit work. The other issue that may arise in the context
of... Well, we don't have any evidence of that here, that there were subs that...
Well, there's nothing in this particular record with respect to that. I can tell the court there are other grievances pending, there are other matters in the district court with respect to those violations, but with respect to the issue, this was never addressed by the district court because the court was really, again, on the threshold question of whether or not to submit to arbitration, ruled against J.W. Peters and directed the parties to submit such matters to the Joint Arbitration Board, which subsequent to April 29th, there have been at least three cases submitted for grievance arbitration to the Joint Arbitration Board. With respect to the other issues that could arise despite the fact that there are no employees in the unit at a particular time, I think the court needs to understand that in this particular industry, it is not unusual for these types of contracts to not be used for any number of years, but it still allows both of the parties to understand and identify their particular rights under the agreement. What in this case, in this context, for instance, there may be an issue with respect to whether or not work that may be assigned to another group of employees represented by a different union is in fact work covered by this agreement. the contract provides for the resolution of the such disputes in the jurisdictional dispute context under the agreement. And this would, just the mere fact that there are no employees under that agreement would not prevent the Joint Arbitration Board or, in the other case, the Joint Conference Board, if it's a jurisdiction dispute, allowing the parties to resolve that dispute. So the important thing about pre-hire agreements and what the Congress recognizes is that it defines the relationship between the parties for a definite period of time. And the fact that, in this case, if J.W. Peters does not, for whatever reason, hire any further employees who are covered by this agreement, it will not be prejudiced or harmed with respect to requiring it to abide by the contract. At the same time, allowing the contract to remain in effect allows the union to enforce that contract through peaceful means, that is, through grievance arbitration and resort to the district court under Section 301 to resolve claims with respect to subcontracting, with respect to awarding work to other employees represented by another union, to hiring non-union employees to perform this work or work that may be arguably covered by the collective bargaining agreement. For all those reasons, for the reasons that the Congress recognized, 8F agreements are important. It's necessary in this context to permit the union to seek to enforce its contractual rights, despite the fact that in other contexts, in other cases, the NLRB may decide that there's no duty to bargain. We believe that in this context, with respect to the duty to comply with the contractual obligations, that the contract is clearly enforceable with respect to those matters, and that with respect to this particular case, that Judge Shader, at the time he ruled on the initial decision to whether or not to stay these matters and submit it to arbitration, was a matter properly for the district court. It is the position of the ironworkers that there's no statutory right to abrogate by J.W. Peters. They had voluntarily signed this collective bargaining agreement at the time, both initially in 1970 and repeatedly over the years, most recently in December of 2002. They never submitted prior to the expiration of the prior agreement in 2003 any written termination of notice. So, for instance, unlike Baylor Heating, which had actually submitted a proper termination, and then the union sought by interest arbitration to seek to compel the particular employer to have a new agreement, this is not like that situation. I would also point out something not included in the briefs with respect to Baylor Heating, that the employer in that case raised the one-unit rule issue in the context of public policy, arguing that the one-man unit rule of the NLRB should govern the application of the interest arbitration provision of that agreement. And in footnote 4 in Baylor Heating, this court found that particular argument with respect to the one-man unit rule to be without merit. Again, in this case, the real issue with respect to the DECLA rulings and with respect to the balancing between Section 8F rights and Section 7 rights of the employees is that in this context, in this particular instance, the employer is not going to be injured or harmed by requiring it to maintain a contract in effect through the life of the term, that is through 2006. It is no at this particular time any employees are affected, and at the same time the union is not going to be able to seek an election or seek to represent the majority of any employees so long as this particular employer does not employ any of those employees through the end of the period of the year. So that, for instance, the question about whether or not a representational election could be held or should have been held, or the reason that it can't be held should be some issue, is it works both ways. The employer can't seek an RM petition, as is indicated in the record. At the same time, the union can't seek an election to represent these employees because there are, for all intent and purposes, none that would qualify to vote, at least at this particular time. But in any event, there's no interference or inability for J.W. Peters to continue to operate currently, and for that reason, we believe that its contractual obligations voluntarily entered into in 2002 should be recognized, and for that reason, the decision of the district court on April 29th should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Deedy. Mr. Gore?
First of all, in Baylor Heating, there was no evidence that of a stable one-person or no-person unit presented to the court. Also, that case was a case dealing with a refusal to bargain and a refusal to enter into a contract after the case went before an arbitrator who enforced an interest arbitration clause. And an interest arbitration clause is a clause that allows an arbitrator to continue a contract through the future. The court said in Baylor that although it was going to allow the contract to continue in the future based on the arbitrator's decision, it was not going to allow the arbitrator to put in a new interest arbitration clause, which would have given the employer the right to repudiate at a later time. The NLRB has specifically stated in Stack and Haas that an employer can lawfully repudiate an agreement, lawfully cancel its agreement. That's what those cases say. It says it's not a violation of the act when they do so, but it also specifically says that they can lawfully repudiate. Also, under a pre-hire agreement, had J.W. Peters employed employees, those employees could have chosen to decertify the union. And in that case, any agreement with the union between J.W. Peters and the union would have been lawfully repudiated, and it would have not existed. The union couldn't come in and make that claim. Finally,
Ms. Gore, do you want to urge upon us that we explicitly adopt the one-man unit exception to the declaration? Is that
yes, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. If there's a stable no-person or one-person unit, then an employer may lawfully repudiate the contract so long as there's no holding by the NLRB, as in Garmin, that a contract exists, which the court found in that case there was a collateral estoppel issue. But we would urge this court to adopt the one-man unit rule consistent with what's been found in the Ninth Circuit.
All right. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Gore.
You.
Thank you, Mr. Deedy. Ms. Weiner, thank you. The case is taken under advisement. And.